open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes, please. Ecclesiastes. Got about 12 texts from Pastor Jim during the service, in case you're wondering. Now, he is on his way to teach a class at Bob Jones this week, and so our prayers are with him, and he's just trying to annoy me. You know how he goes. Ecclesiastes, please. Do you remember the things in your past that you thought were so important to you, maybe as a kid? And now you look back and you're like, that was so meaningless. That didn't have any purpose. It meant so much to me. I was so concerned about it, like stressed out about it, willing to fight over it. And look back, I'm like, that was pointless. The Ecclesiastes, the title of the message tonight is More Meaning Less. More Meaning Less. So, think back. I think back of examples in my life where I thought something was so important, and here's one. Sitting in the front seat. That was so important to me. I mean, if I said shotgun first, I get the front seat. That's how it works. I love my mom used to say, you know we're all going to the same place, right? Oh, yeah. Why does it matter what you how you ride there? So that was so important. Now I look back like, are you serious? Like, it's not that big of a deal. Maybe it's this or that basketball game or sports game, whatever that we just thought, whether we're participating in it or we're just watching it, we think this is going to make my life, you know? Here I am, 12 years old, playing an important basketball game that it's just going to make my life or break my life. And in losses, we just weep, you know, like our lives are over. And in victories, we think we're on top of the world. And we look back and wonder, how important was that, you know, seventh grade basketball championship game in Central Illinois with a bunch of other small Christian schools? And as we grow older, we look back and we think, there's some things that we thought were so important to us. We look back and we're like, that really wasn't that important. Well, this is the kind of thing that's happening in Ecclesiastes. It's kind of like an older man, a mature man, is looking back on life and thinking, what was that about? That seemed pointless. This seemed meaningless. Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why does this happen like that? It doesn't seem like it is supposed to happen that way. What in the world was that kind of talk that we're going to see throughout here? The title of this book is Ecclesiastes. It's actually taken from a Greek word and transliterated into English, Ecclesiastes, and it might sound familiar. The New Testament word for church is ekklesia, and it's that same kind of word that's being used. And so Ecclesiastes is the title. The Hebrew word is Kohelet. You might hear me say that a couple of times, spelled Q-O-H-O-L-E-T, Kohelet. And this is the preacher, the teacher. Sometimes, maybe a more generic translation would be something like the assembler. The one who gathers or who assembles or the one who speaks at an assembly. People are gathering in order to hear this person speak or teach. So some of your translations might have that word in the very first verse there. The words of the preacher, son of David, the king of Jerusalem, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Might have that translated teacher, might have that translated preacher or something else. Now, this is actually presented, just to give you a little structure of Ecclesiastes, help us think through how we should read this text. There is this speech by the teacher or the preacher is framed by a narrator. And we call that guy the frame narrator. It's very complicated. The frame narrator. So you'll see this in the first 11 verses. somebody, it's presented as if somebody else is writing. And then in verse 12, now the preacher is talking. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. So in the first 11 verses, he's talking about the preacher. And then look at the very end. Look at chapter 12 in verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. So now we're talking third person again about the preacher. And so the last part, so you see how this speech, these words of the preacher are framed by a narrator. So he's going to help us think through what's going on here. Now, who is the preacher? Well, it's just the preacher. It might be Solomon. Most people think it's probably not Solomon for a few reasons. I don't personally think it's Solomon because of a couple inconsistencies, but that's neither here nor there. It's just my opinion. The author is at least trying to adopt a Solomonic persona. So the author wants us to have Solomon in mind, at least wants us to have Solomon. If it's not Solomon himself writing this, at least have Solomon in mind as we read, especially in the first three chapters. Then the Solomonic persona is not quite as strong throughout the rest of the book, but at least in these first three chapters. We're going to try and cover the first two chapters tonight, so buckle up. All right, so look at verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Then he says this, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You get the point? See, so in that word, vanity, translated vanity in my translation, can be translated a lot of different ways. That word is used 73 times in the Old Testament and 38 times in Ecclesiastes. Its importance is significant here. You see it in verse 2. You see it about five times in verse 2. And then in chapter 12, verse 8, I just read that text to you. Chapter 12, verse 8, you see it again. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So think about the way that is set up. Vanity of vanities. Just that phrase. You have singular of plural. So singular word, same word, plural word. So of. You see this in other instances in the scriptures as well. So it is the vanity of all vanities, or it is maybe a better translation would be something like meaninglessness. That's just really hard to say. Meaninglessnesses of meaninglessnesses or something like that. It might be a better translation that way. Sometimes the word vain in this kind of translation can make us think of kind of self-centeredness. And that's not necessarily the point here. The understanding is typically around a better translation might be around meaninglessness. So, you see in this text, you see like the Holy of Holies. Or he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. He's not just Lord, he's the Lord of all lords. So this is the meaninglessness of all meaninglessnesses. It's really hard to say. We're going to try it though for the rest of the night, so this will be fun. Now, and when you see repetition in Hebrew language, he's trying to drive home a point. So in narrative, in the Hebrew text here, when you see repetition, he's trying to make a huge point. And he is definitely repeating himself in this one verse. So this phrase, this vanity of vanities, it's bookend. They stand as bookends in the book. In chapter 1, verse 2, and chapter 12, verse 8. It's this oversimplified summary at the beginning of what's going to be coming, at the end of what has already happened, what he's already talked about. At the end, he's like, see, I told you, everything is meaningless. Literally, this word means breath or vapor, but it's often used metaphorically. Literal translation doesn't help too much. Metaphorically, it kind of can be time-related, passing. It's worthless, it's trivial, vanity. It's nonsense, it's senseless, doesn't make sense in our mind, it's incomprehensible, like what is going on here? It's illogical, it's irrational. One of my favorite translations of this word comes from a guy named Michael Fox. He says the word's the best translation, best fits mostly in this text, in this book, as absurd. Absurdity of absurdities. So, when contradictions in life happen, and they can't be explained, the author calls them absurd. The wicked prosper. What's up with that? This guy does the work, but this guy gets the goods. It's absurd. Actually, he finds all things under the sun to be meaningless or absurd. Really? All things? Meaningless? Like everything? Well, to summarize what he says throughout this book, Mark Dever has been a huge help in this, and he has listed three categories of meaninglessness that the preacher covers. He covers the first category would be obvious things, much dreaming and many words in chapter 5, verse 7. Chapter 6, verse 9, this roving appetite, meaninglessness. The laughter of fools, chapter 7, verse 6. Laughter of fools is meaningless. This kind of injustice where the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer, chapter 8, verse 14. It doesn't seem to fit the Proverbs mindset, the Proverbs mold, where you have a proverb like in chapter 12, verse 21, no ill befalls the righteous, but the wicked are filled with trouble. It seems to be flip-flopped here in Ecclesiastes. What's up with that? Are those things true? It's meaningless. It's absurd when you see the wicked. And we see that. We see that today. We see that often. Where the wicked prosper. It's absurd. It's meaningless. So the first thing is the obvious things. The first category would be obvious things. We look at that and we're like, that is obviously absurd. It's meaninglessness. The second thing is this kind of questionable or neutral things, Mark Dever adds. He says, trying to find pleasure. It's not necessarily wrong to try to find pleasure, but he says finding pleasure is meaningless. Popularity is not necessarily a bad thing if you're well-liked by a lot of people. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But he says that's also meaningless. It's absurd, finding popularity. Dever quotes part of a story, tells part of a story in his sermon on this in his book by George Orwell. And the story is called Shooting an Elephant. I won't get into the whole story, but at the end, he says he's trying to decide whether or not to shoot this elephant. And it's a long story. And he says, the crowd will laugh at me, and my whole life was one long struggle not to be laughed at. It's where you have in a position where somebody has become so popular among the people that becomes his goal, his idol. And he ends up, this leader ends up being controlled by the people. Spoiler alert, sorry. The third category is good things. So the first category is obvious things. The second category was questionable or kind of neutral things. And the third category is actually good things. He looks at good things and says, it's absurd. Youth and vigor, chapter 11, verse 10. Youth and vigor, he calls that meaningless. Work, in chapter 2, verse 4 through 11, he says that's meaningless. Money, chapter 5, verse 10. These are good things. He says that's meaningless. Wisdom, in chapter 1, verse 17, chapter 2, verse 15, he says that's meaningless. Life in general, just because I forgot something. Life in general, in chapter 7, verse 15, meaningless. The future, chapter 11, verse 7 through 8, is meaningless. Get the point? All things are meaningless. Absurdity of absurdities. Everything is absurd. Why? Well, look at this rhetorical question you have in verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Now, this phrase, under the sun, is used 29 times in the Old Testament, only in Ecclesiastes. It's a significant phrase, under the sun. It's earthly as opposed to divine. What does it profit a man from all his labor which he toils under the sun? What does it profit a man? Chapter 1, verse 14. He says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is meaningless and grasping for the wind. I love that imagery. You see that imagery throughout this book of Ecclesiastes. And the last time I taught this, I thought it would be appropriate for me to just give you an example of what that would look like. And so just imagine Pastor Jim out in this field over here chasing after the wind, okay? That's absurd. Just running around, running around trying to grab a hold of the wind. We would say this guy is crazy. But so that's what he's saying. This is absurd for somebody to work. It's meaningless. Chapter 2, verse 11, there is no profit under the sun. No labor is properly rewarded. This is seen even in the elements of nature. So look with me in verse 4, down to verse 7. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. So notice the cyclical nature of things here. The wind, verse 6, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. You ever thought about that? Like streams, why does this lake not overflow? Like, this river keeps going into this lake and it's still not overflowing. Sometimes it does. But why is it not overflowing? Like, what's going on there? All this work for this water to wind down this mountain and just to be just a part of this huge sea. And it doesn't change a bit. Generations, the sun, the wind, the water, they never stop. And they don't care about you. Though mighty and incessant, they seem to accomplish nothing in particular, it seems. It's just cyclical, just happens over and over and over and over again. This world is perceived as a cold and impersonal place. So what's the point? Well, one big point here is that we're not nearly as important as we thought we were. You ever have this kind of moment? When you go somewhere thinking you're pretty important, but then you realize you're not that important. Not as important as you thought you were. I'm sure we've all had those kinds of experiences. So what's the reaction here? Verse 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We are never satisfied. All these things just keep happening over and over, and we have no satisfaction. For some reason, we think this world under the sun has something to offer us. And it never happens. We need to stop wasting our time, stop wasting our life pursuing these things under the sun. Verse 9. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been done in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. There's nothing new under the sun. People just trying to find pleasure in this thing or that thing or the same kind of thing that people have been trying to find pleasure in for centuries. It's all meaningless. It's pointless. Aren't you glad you came Sunday night at service? There's nothing new under the sun. And in verse 11, everyone will be forgotten. Everyone is going to die. No one will remember you. How frail, Job says this in chapter 14, verse 1 and 2. How frail is humanity? How short is life? How full of trouble? We blossom like a flower, then we wither. Like a passing shadow, we quickly disappear. So imagine with me. You think that's true? Like, you really think that that's true? Like, we're all basically going to die and no one will remember us. So think back with me to your great, great, great grandfather. Remember him? Me neither. I don't either. My brother posted a picture of my great, great, great grandfather one time, and that's the only thing I know about him, because he looks exactly like my brother. It was really weird. And this big beard and everything. It's beautiful. But, I mean, what do I know about this? What do I know about, I mean, I have lots of great-great-great-grandfathers. I have no idea their names. No idea who they're. Remember Abraham Lincoln's friend's cousin? Me neither. No idea. And really, we read about Lincoln, right? I grew up in the land of Lincoln, Illinois. And we read about Lincoln. We're, you know, have our different opinions probably on Lincoln. Everybody has an idea about who Lincoln is and what he did. But do we really know him? Do we really know him? The ins and outs of his life are forgotten. Maybe Greg McCoskey has a better idea of who Lincoln is than most of us. But do we really know these people? We might know about them and things they've done, some really cool things here and there, but do we really know them? Well, that's encouraging. Now, the teacher is going to explore a couple different areas in the rest of this chapter and the next chapter, and we're going to fly through them. So, here we go. The preacher. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. So, we're to think of this preacher, Kohelet, in terms of Solomon. Solomon is his model. He's gonna take on that persona, at least. If it's not him, it may be him. If it's not him, he's at least taking on the persona in this first few chapters. Verse 13. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. To search and explore wisely or by wisdom, it's an evil task that's given by God. Just to keep them busy, is what he's saying. Trying to find meaning in life, an evil task that keeps them busy. Keep going. Verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. Remember Pastor Jim out in the field over there? Striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, I perceived that this is also but striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. He says, in great wisdom comes great discomfort. You see that? Much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge, he actually increases sorrow. Really? That's not what I thought. But think about that. Is that really true? I mean, it forces you. Wisdom and knowledge forces us to take in information, and we see life's absurdities. We see in Proverbs, which is also true, that wisdom brings joy in life, and it's true. Ecclesiastes says it brings pain and frustration. Why do you think that is? Because both are true. In preparation for this study, Kohelet, the author, the preacher, he tries to gain wisdom and knowledge. And he succeeded. And he found it frustrating, frustratingly absurd, as if wisdom had all the answers. Maybe the thinking is something like this, you know, the more I study this particular subject, the more I realize how much I don't know. Or the more we take in information about the world around us, the more we see this is difficult. This is frustrating. It brings pain in my life when I learn certain things. Now, what about pleasure? Seems like it would be a good thing to pursue. Pleasure. So look with me in verse 1 of chapter 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this was also absurd. It's also meaningless. He states his quest to find pleasure, to find the value in pleasure, and then he states his conclusion, meaningless. So look with me. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of men to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I love to laugh, don't you? I love to laugh. He says, what's the point of laughing? What's that about? The preacher examines folly, but he never admits to actually indulging in it. Look at chapter 2, verse 9. He kept wisdom with him. Wisdom remained with him. The pleasure he tries are not intrinsically foolish. They are the very same ones he recommends elsewhere. But even these, when measured against the criterion of profitability, are foolish, says Michael Fox. So some of these things are actually fine things to pursue. He actually says these are good things to pursue later on. But when you look at it on the criterion of profitability, foolish. Look at verse 4. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold in the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men. He keeps saying this repetition of myself. I tried to emphasize that. His purpose is self-pleasure, not others, and it doesn't satisfy. It just doesn't satisfy. You would think if I was able to do all these things for myself, and I had people to like mow my lawn and fix my car whenever I wanted them to and whatever it is, and I would just be living large. I would be so satisfied if I had this. And this guy's like, been there, done that. It's no good. It doesn't satisfy. It's absurd. He had people. He had the feel goods, money, musicians. He had his own musicians, his own band. Named after him, maybe. I don't know. He had sexual pleasures of many kinds. And he said, meaningless. It's meaningless. Verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure from my heart. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So the summary of making himself feel really good: there's no restraint. He did not hold back. Nothing held back. Whatever his eyes requested, he granted his eyes. And then he mentions all three of his favorite phrases. It's all vanity, chasing after the wind, no profit under the sun. Verse 11. So this should be a wake-up call. We need to stop pursuing things under the sun as if they can give us pleasure. True pleasure. Because they can't. He's been there. I remember I read this article one time about the greatest basketball player that ever played. Not me. You guys were going to say me, but not me. Michael Jordan. He. This ESPN article, and talking about how successful this man was and how unsatisfied he is right now. You would think. I mean, I remember thinking, like, if I was the greatest basketball player in the entire world, I mean, that'd be it. I would be feeling great, and I would be just satisfied in life. And newsflash, it's not true. And here we have the preacher telling us, I've been there, done that, it's not satisfying. Well, what about work? What about work? Verse 18, or verse, oh no, what about, sorry, wise versus fool, verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what he's already done. Then I saw that there was more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Same event. Verse 15. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. so I hated life. Because what is done under the sun, was grievous to me. For all is vanity and striving after the wind." So he examines wisdom and folly. I like the idea of examining wisdom, so happiness by addition, by adding things, and folly can be sometimes explained as happiness by subtraction. Okay, think about that. So wisdom, kind of this highbrow life, like I'm going to get these cars and this stuff and all these things and these musicians, and folly, happiness by subtraction. I'm just going to live a simple life. The redneck life, if you will. I'm just going to chill and just not bother anybody. Just live this simple life. And he says it's foolishness. So he says, "I hated life." Looking back on the events of the past, and no one really remembers. And again, he uses his three favorite phrases. Under the sun, all is vanity, grasping for the wind. And what about work? What about work? He says, well, that's pretty frustrating too. "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun," verse 18, "seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun." This is vanity. It's meaningless, absurd. Verse 20, "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun." Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This is also absurd and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart for which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This is also absurd. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his work. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This is also vanity and striving after the wind. So it's a frustration. He is powerless in his work, and what happens with his work and his profit and his wealth, he feels frustrated. Like, I don't have control over any of that. It's an injustice. One person works, and this wise person or this fool benefits. It's an injustice. His heritage is left for someone who has not worked for it. His heart takes no rest, not because of evil, but Kehelet says, the teacher says, because of burdensome work. So, just eat, drink, and enjoy your work. Because work in and of itself is from the hand of God. Work is actually a good thing. Man was called to work in the garden before the fall. It's a good thing. And the one God favors, in verse 26, the one God favors, and there's one that God disfavors, an offender. God is in control. So take it easy and enjoy what falls to one's lot in life. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who he favors. So living wisely means just enjoying his life and taking what comes his way. Enjoy working. He finds enjoyment in his toil. And we can't be obsessed with the outcome. Can't be obsessed with the outcome. Let God deal with that. So a couple of points of application. Just four things real quick. Number one, we're not as important as we think we are. Okay? Do we realize how tiny we are? Sometimes you fly in a plane, you're like, well, I'm pretty tiny. And sometimes we just forget, we think we're just all kinds of important. Do we really know, realize how seemingly insignificant we are in the grand scheme of things? You realize that? But how important we are to God. Number two, don't live for things under the sun. They can't provide satisfaction. They promise satisfaction. Things under the sun, things of this earth, they promise satisfaction, and what does Matthew chapter 6 say? Moth and rust destroys them. Thieves break in and steal that stuff. Don't live for these things that promise satisfaction but really can't offer it. wisdom, pleasure, simple life, work life. Don't live for those things. Live for God. Number three, God is in control of everything. Just follow him. God is in control of everything. So look at the very end of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Look at chapter 12. Here's the end of the matter. This is the big spoiler. I hope you read the rest of it. Chapter 12, verse 13. The end of the matter. All has been heard. Here's the end of the matter. Fear God. Keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. God's in control. He's sovereign. Follow him. Trust him in this way. The last thing, we have hope. There really is something over the sun. We have the ability to connect to living for God through the work of Christ on the cross. We really can have relationship with God. We can live for something greater than these things. We really can follow hard after God and enjoy him. In his right hand are pleasures forevermore. We really can do what's right and enjoy life in this way. And even in suffering, we can enjoy life. Romans 8 says this in closing. Read this text and we'll pray. If I can find Romans. Romans 8 says this. Romans 8 and verse 18. He's going to use the word that the Greek Old Testament uses for meaninglessness. And I'll make it obvious. Listen to this. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. Do you get that point? I'm going to read that again. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to, here it is, futility. Meaninglessness, absurdity. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage of corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly as we eagerly wait for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. Now, hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So we have a hope. We have a real life hope for something over the sun. We really can hope in God. There's something greater to live for in these things. Let's pray. Dear God, help us to live like we believe that. Help us to fear you and to keep your commandments, to go hard after our great God. Help us not to live for things of this world that promise satisfaction, but are just lying to us. Help us to believe in the one who is truth, who has pleasures forevermore. Lord, we forgive us for living for things here on this earth and counting them as more important than living for you. Will you help us? Will you help us to remember that you are in control of all things, and when we see inconsistencies, we don't fret. We trust our great God. You're in control of all things. Thank you that we can have a hope, a glorious hope in the restoration of all things, a glorious hope that we will one day be above the sun. So will you help us in thinking through this week? As we go into this week, will you help us to be people who are trusting you with our lives? Guide us in this, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.